Osiris.
Then all of a sudden, your drug of choice changes. John buys acid for the very first time. And when he pulls up at home with two caps that he had purchased for apparently 10 bucks a piece, it's cheaper now. I don't know how that works. There's Cass standing at your door waiting for you.
That's when the acid hit me.
Welcome to Discograffiti, the music obsessives podcast that gives freaks like you and me the chance to connect with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with 3 to 4 episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. Each new guest swings a hard left into an area you either had no idea you needed to know about or know all about and can't believe you're not alone out there. I am thrilled to announce that we have partnered with the podcast network Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music. You can check out all their music podcasts at osirispod.com. And in this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on the Mamas and the Papas, along with our unbelievably special guests, band biographer Richard Campbell, who's published an amazing bio, almost like a prequel really, called Getting Kinda Itchy, and Be Still My Beating Heart, the absolutely radiant goddess herself, Michelle Phillips, who'll be sifting through the sacred transmissions issued forth from her younger self and rating them all, every last LP and single, from 0 to 5 stars. This is part one of an epic new series culled from a 16-hour interview called Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime, in which Michelle looks back with shockingly raw candor at a life exquisitely well-lived. In part one, we'll learn about the group's very first acid trip together, Michelle's intense hatred toward one of the Mamas and the Papas' biggest ever hits, and in all likelihood, the most mythologically crazy backstory in rock history. Before we kick things off, just a quick word from Michelle.
Hey, lads and ladies. Michelle Phillips here from the Mamas and the Papas. If you're like me and you want it all, then why in the world would you settle for a trimmed-down version of my interview? To get access to the extended director's cut of this and all future episodes, just join Discograffiti's Patreon. Dave Gebro's been singing for his supper for over 2 years now. The guy puts out several shows a week, and it's just the best music podcast of all time. You're not going to want to miss a single minute of it. Patreon.com/Discograffiti. Do it.
If you're a Michelle Phillips and Mamas and the Papas super fan like me, you'll want to turn this free version off right now and opt for the ultimate director's cut of this episode on our Patreon page, which features a whopping 18 additional minutes of essential material. And you can find it in our Patreon record shop for mere pennies at patreon.com/discograffiti/shop. Or just subscribe for the complete versions of all our shows. Even if you're on the fence, just head over there, because it's finally free to become a basic member. I'm going to take this opportunity now to give a shout out to brand new Patreon member Tyler Davis, an 18-year-old young man with great taste and a soft spot for the Mamas and the Papas, who literally canceled his cable TV and subscribed to Discograffiti at the Brigadier General tier, which is $40 a month. Trust me, if he can find a way, so can you. Tyler, I love you, and you are seriously my hero. Okay, first things first, you need to know just how seriously I take this craziness. Discograffiti is a music obsessive's dream come true. The guest and I explore an artist or band's entire discography in a futile but valiant attempt to reach a higher truth, which often is cleverly disguised as a nerdy compendium of star ratings and lists. The show is heavily researched, and the music is always reassessed with fresh ears. We don't just cover albums. We do a searingly honest deep dive analysis of all EPs, singles, comp tracks, relevant solo work, and sometimes even bootlegs and live stuff. Every release is slapped with an objectively accurate star rating between 0 and 5, which allows us all, the real reason we do this, the Tootsie Pop reward at the center of the rock and roll lolly, to come face to face with the true shape of an artist's overall arc. Coming up, we've got Robert Schneider raiding the strawberry alarm clock, the lemon twigs, and the three surviving Dedrick siblings raiding everything they ever released as one of the greatest bands of all time, bar none, The Free Design. Not to mention tons more Michelle Phillips, so don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And away we go then!
Are there things that I cannot say? Are there words that I cannot?
Not even close. And I would love to see you push that line.
Okay.
I really would. If there's anyone who's going to do it, it's you.
Okay. Do I need some powder?
I swear to God, you look so beautiful. Michelle, honestly, I took one look at you and I thought, without even looking at a script, I could do an improvised version of Harold and Maude with you right now.
Well, I'm very appreciative of that. Mm-hmm.
You look absolutely beautiful. You really do. You don't need any hair, makeup, anything.
It'd be 80 in June.
I know, that's nuts. All right, here it goes. Here we go.
Let's go.
And away we go then. Tonight, we've got two guests. First, the man responsible for this happening at all. Our Papa guest is the first honest-to-goodness judge we've ever had on Discography. Yeah, that's right, including me, mainly due to my wardrobe being 100% bereft of flowing robes. Once dubbed the Keeper of the Flame by Michelle Phillips herself, he's the foremost authority on the Mamas and the Papas, having penned dozens of liner notes, served as an expert on TV specials, consulted on theater productions, and collected thousands of band-related artifacts. Lads and ladies, will you please pound your music snob gavel for the one and only Richard Campbell?
Yay!
Thank you.
Guilty.
And then our mama guest. Someone please pinch me, seriously. Our next guest is a singer, an actress, a mom, a total sweetheart, and one hell of a raconteur. Her voice was described by Time magazine as the purest soprano in pop music.
Uh-uh.
No?
The purest soprano in popdom.
Popdom. I've been corrected during the intro in a Discography first. She's also enjoyed an astonishingly prolific career as an actress in film and television beginning in the early 70s. A native of Long Beach, California, a town I just fled from, she met and married John Phillips and went on to co-found the Mamas and the Papas in 1965. They, of course, rose to fame lightning quick with hugely popular singles like California Dreamin' and Creaky Alley, both of which she co-wrote. They released 5 studio albums before imploding in one of music history's most spectacular fashions ever. She's the last surviving original member of the band, and she's here to tell her story. And as always, she's all about the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and we love her like crazy for it. Lads and ladies, will you please swoon along with me as one of the all-time greats steps back up to the mic? It's the bombshell of vocal bombast, the mischievous mama on which every man and woman's got a lifelong crush. Let's welcome to the hallowed halls of Discography, Michelle Phillips!
Yay!
I can't believe it! I am so psyched to have you here. I really am.
And just let me tell you that I fled Long Beach when I was about 2 hours old. Never went back.
Smart woman. Just before it was infiltrated by Dre and Snoop.
I was born free there.
It is well established that Richard is in over his head with his obsession with you guys. But I want to say, because, you know, every week I do an episode on, or episodes on bands that are disparate all over the map. I mean, we had the Association on recently, but also all kinds of other groups you may or may not have heard of. The Mamas and the Papas, to me, are one of the best and most important bands that ever walked the face of the earth. And it's not just the music, it's the story, it's the blending of personalities. Just like if you just take one of the Beatles out, it's just not the Beatles. This has meant so much to me that I am actually at a breaking point in terms of what I can handle in terms of work. Every day for the last few weeks, I've been waking up at 3-4 in the morning, listening and researching. This goes on then from 3-4 in the morning till my son comes home from preschool at 5:00. And then I have to decompress. Maybe I'll read, you know, some of your book. This is very, very important. This is not just another episode.
David, David, you sound nuts.
I'm nuts. But
totally obsessed. You need a very mild sedative.
Look, the fact that you are prescribing a mild sedative for me is so sweet of you.
Well,
you're just being nice. Well, I don't have a bottle of wine here, unfortunately, but let me, if I may, and I want Richard for sure to jump in on this as well. I always have a very brief section at the head explaining what the band means to me. And there's no better tale that represents this than October 18th, 2002. October 18th, 2002, I was at the absolute apex of my obsession with the band. Dream a Little Dream, I had just seen that in New York, Denny's play. I was driving to the movies and listening to If I Could Believe My Eyes and Ears, and I got shouldered off the highway and found myself in a forest adjacent to the highway, running down trees and hitting a final tree that came down on my car, and I got out just before the car exploded, okay? As I crawled down the embankment. The song that was soundtracking this whole event was Got a Feeling, which is such a strange dichotomy from what was happening with me. So I get to the hospital and my family, you know, get there and I say, there's stuff at home that I need. I need to get stuff at home. And what I did was I went home and I got all my mama's and papa's stuff. I was at that time I was reading Papa John. I got my Papa John book. I'm sorry that it was Papa John, but I just want to tell the truth. And then I left the hospital to get my stash of mama's and papa's stuff after having an accident where my car exploded. That's how much I like your band.
I appreciate that. I don't know what to say, except that I'm going to up your dosage.
Fair enough. How about you, Richard? This is going to be a crazier story probably because he's way in.
So this is a 1980s thing. I was in high school and it was kind of cool if you were an 80s kid to like the Doors or, you know, 60s groups. So I had a friend that gave me my first record and I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. And at the same time, either that friend or another friend, their parents had been to a Journeyman concert here at the University of Richmond. And so, as we were wont to do in the 80s, sitting around listening to records, I'm looking at both these records. I'm like, wait a minute. This is the same guy. You know, so I start to make the connections. And I bought all of the albums at one time. So I just completely marinated in it. And I managed to land an interview with Denny with our big AM radio station here, which for a 16, 17-year-old, I felt like I had really done something. So from there, I met Owen and I met Michelle and I started getting contacted by record companies when CDs started coming out to write liner notes.
I will say that whenever I need an answer to a mama's and papa's question, I always go to Richard because he knows everything.
Let's talk about the characters in today's episode. We have the venerable Michelle Phillips, John Phillips, Cass Elliott, and Denny Doherty. As far as your sound and influence, just in case you happen to have crawled out from under a rock momentarily and you've been living there for a very long time, the Mamas and Papas were a folk rock vocal group which existed mainly from 65 to 68. They were a defining force in the counterculture of the 60s, although that might be hard for kids of today to actually hear in the music because counterculture now is just slinging around a bunch of F-words. Back then, I mean, because looking back now, it feels like sunny AM stuff. You would never know, based on the way today's music is, what was hiding behind the shadows if you weren't familiar with the story. The sound was based on vocal harmonies arranged by John, who was the songwriter, musician, and leader of the group, who adapted folk to the new Beatles-influenced rock style after being pressured incessantly by his bandmates, thank God. And then this is the funniest fucking sentence of all time. In 1959, John apparently said, "My group had to harmonize with the best of them and get along smoothly." Well, I guess one out of two ain't bad. All right, so the first thing that I'd love to know, because obviously I know about The Hungry Eye and meeting John, but when was your flashpoint moment of creative epiphany, your holy shit moment when you knew you could sing? Was it before John?
I never thought I could sing, and I was dragged kicking and screaming into the group. I had no ambition to be a singer. I had never thought about it. And I was actually modeling in New York and making tons of money. I was perfectly happy being a model. And then when the Journeymen broke up, John just kind of casually said to me one day, he says, you know, you're going to be in the new group. And I said, what? He says, yeah, you're going to be in the new group. I said, John, I can't sing. He says, Michelle, you sing just fine. John had this feeling, and it turned out to be kind of true in a way. He said, you know, anybody can sing. It's just a matter of practice and learning how to sing. Just like learning to do anything else, learning how to sing is just practice, practice, practice. So I really did not want to do it. But, you know, I said, John, I was making $500 a week, which in 1963 was a lot of money. And Kaiser Roth, which was a lingerie company, wanted to sign an exclusive contract with me. And John said, no, no, Michelle, you're going to be in the group. And I said, but, you know, $500 is a lot of money for a week's work. And he said, you'll make more money singing than modeling. And so based on greed alone, I agreed to join the group.
But did you enjoy singing? And also, along with that, do you feel like you became a great singer because of John's taskmaster leader abilities? Or do you really feel that you had it in you from when you were born?
I don't think I had it in me from the time I was born. Although when I look back on my life, I realize that I did sing. I used to sing with my sister when we were on road trips with my dad. We used to drive from Mexico City to the U.S. border every 6 months to renew our visas for 5 years. And my sister and I would sit in the back seat of the old Plymouth and sing songs. And then when we would stay with our grandparents, we sang at church because my grandfather was a Baptist minister. So you had to sing hymns. And then, of course, I was hugely influenced by the girl groups of the early 60s, you know, the Shirelles, the Chantels, the Crystals, the Marvelettes, you know, you name them. I loved them.
So your mom passed away when you were five. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Was that part of the impetus that had you going to New York and moving out to San Francisco and flying around the country like a feather a little bit because of that early trauma?
No, I think it was the fact that my father would let me go to San Francisco in the first place. I was still in high school, but I wanted to go up and spend the summer with Tamar, who was my best friend, and she had moved back to San Francisco. And he said, you know, okay, but be back to start ironing your blouses for the fall. But once I got up there, I started to meet all these fascinating musicians, and there was no chance that I was going to go back and start ironing my blouses, I'll tell you. You know, really, that opened up a whole new world to me when I was going to the Hungry Eye, and I had a beautiful little black cocktail dress, and my hair was up, and I was wearing makeup, and that's exactly where I wanted to be, right there, smack in the middle of the scene in San Francisco. The Hungry Eye was the club that everybody wanted to play. And the Journeymen were opening for Dick Gregory. And we went to see Dick one night, and we were escorted to our table right next to the stage. And John Phillips and Scott McKenzie and Dick Weissman were singing and playing. And John and I just made eye contact. And I just thought, oh, he's so great. He's the leader of the band.
Weren't you first interested primarily in Scott McKenzie, though?
No, that was Tamar.
Okay.
I had no relationship with Scott, although Scott was a doll, and he was the most beautiful tenor that I had ever heard sing.
My favorite thing about all this early information is the fact that you just come across like a force in nature, like a fireball, really, because you're 17. There's a 10-year age difference. John's married. He's got two kids. They just traveled all the way across the country together. And you're like, well, I want what I want. What do you want me to tell you? So do you remember from your present point of view, I'm curious, do you judge the actions of a 17-year-old Michelle Phillips? Or are you just like, oh, that's so silly that I did that? When you think about that, no judgment here until you find the one. It's fair game. I that's what I think.
Shut.
And now, an important message from Don Bowles.
Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for District Attorney of Los Angeles who has over a decade of experience successfully defending those falsely accused of crimes. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate running for Los Angeles District Attorney who is dedicated to ending mass incarceration. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who co-created and produced the televised freakout public access show known as The Three Geniuses, which the LA Weekly dubbed the most intentionally psychedelic show on television. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who is an accomplished phototheremist. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate for Los Angeles District Attorney who now has a record label with punk rock legend and all-around weirdo Don Bowles. Dan Kapelowitz is the only candidate running for Los Angeles District Attorney who was not only the features editor at Hustler Magazine, but also Larry Flint's editorial point man for his First Amendment lawsuit against the military-industrial complex and the Pentagon. If you believe in liberty, justice, and the American way, vote for Dan Kapelowitz. Stick it to the man. Vote for Dan. Dan Kapelowitz.
I'm Dan Kapelowitz, and I approve this message.
Well, you know, I knew that John was cheating on Susie because every time I went to the Hungry Eye, I would see him walk out the door with another woman. And it took a little while for John and I to get together because Scott and Tamar were together at that point and they just never came out of the bedroom. And John would come over to pick Scott up to go for a sound check or for a rehearsal or whatever. And he just didn't want his tenor to get involved with this woman who was causing all this trouble for the group. But then he would come over and John and I started talking, and I actually forget how it all happened, but I just fell in love with him. And I knew that he had a wife and two children, but it didn't seem to bother him any. So we started an affair, and then he and the journeyman had to go on the road. So he told me that he would be back, but he would keep in touch with me. And he didn't keep in touch with me, and he wasn't coming back. And for some odd reason, I thought this was okay, but I went to their apartment in Mill Valley.
I'm making a tuna fish sandwich, getting ready for this thing.
I knocked on the door and Susie answered and I said, "Hi, I'm Michelle." She says, "I know." And she says, "Come on in." And she was very gracious and lovely. And she says, "I'm making tuna sandwiches. Would you like one?" And I said, "Sure." She said, "I'm making some martinis. Would you like a martini?" And I said, "Sure." And we sat there as she told me, "You know, I feel badly for you, but I have to tell you, John has a Michelle in every town. And he's always going to be unfaithful. He's always going to do whatever he wants to do. And, you know, he's going to hurt you." And I thought, after I left, I started thinking about that. And I thought, no, it's not true. He does not have a Michelle in every town. And a couple of weeks later, he knocked on my door and said, "How could you have gone to see Susie? I was in the middle of divorce proceedings." And I said, "Well, why didn't you call me and let me know? Why didn't you call me?" And he said, "It was just stupid, but we're together now and we're going to stay together." And I think it was the fact that I did join the journeyman on the road, which pissed Scott off tremendously, because Scott and Dick and John were like the three musketeers. And now all of a sudden, John had this chick on the road.
It ultimately led to them not even talking to each other, Dave. I talk about this in the book, but the end in 1964, I mean, John would say to Dick, can you please tell Scott this and that sort of thing.
You know, what's interesting about this whole thing is that I've heard John actually describe you as behind the front, you're actually socially shy and vulnerable. Although this does not sound like a tuna fish lunch that would be held by somebody who's shy and vulnerable.
I had no animosity towards Susie. I didn't really feel great about what I was doing, but I also knew that I was in love with John and Susie didn't have him. Really, you know, she was in Mill Valley, but they did not have really a solid marriage at all. And then, you know, when John said, I want you to come to New York with me, I said, well, we have to ask my daddy. And I asked my dad to come up to San Francisco. And of course, John could charm the birds off the trees. And he said to my father, he says, I really will take care of her. I'll take good care of her. I'll teach her everything she has to know. And my father said, yes, I'm sure you will, John. And really, my father realized that I was going to be legally able to walk out that door by myself in just a few months anyway. So he said, okay, John, you can take her to New York. But, you know, she's still in high school. You've been to college. She's not even out of high school. And so then my father said, okay, you can take her to New York, but throw her a book every now and then.
Throw her a book.
You know, that was my father's idea of me getting an education.
Right, right. Just toss her a book every now and then. That's what I do with my son. He's turning out great.
It is the first time I really started to read, and I just never stopped reading. I probably learned a lot more being with John in New York than I would have learned staying at Marshall High School here in Los Angeles.
It kind of sounds like you were right with Susie. In April 62, John gets divorced. December 31st of that year, the two of you marry. And that next year in 63, his writing begins to veer in a romantic direction away from, you know, stuffy, folkier pastures. And obviously because of you. You definitely became his muse. And so I'm trying to read between the lines here, and I want you to smack me across the face metaphorically and tell me I'm wrong. So here's my theory. The pressure of you becoming a muse to someone made you maybe uncomfortable. And so Russ Titelman crosses paths with you. Does that play any part of it? John, will you stop looking at me, writing songs about me, stop putting me on a fucking pedestal? Is any of this stuff playing into the Russ Titelman affair?
Well, the Russ Titelman affair happened right after Kennedy was assassinated. And, you know, I saw in him something very appropriate for an 18-year-old girl. He was like a 19-year-old guy, and he was very cute. And I was very vulnerable at that time, too. My dog died on November 22nd. She was hit by a car.
And oh,
she was,
man.
Aldous Huxley died on November 22nd.
And then you immediately took up his work right where he left off.
Yeah. And so I just did what a 18-year-old girl would do. She falls in love with somebody else. So, you know, it wasn't a odd thing for me to fall in love with Russ Titelman. John wasn't there. And I was getting all this attention from a man, a very young man who was involved in the record business and adored me. And I was ready to leave John.
That early? That early? Really?
That early.
This is 11 months after you got married.
Yes. 11 months, 8 days. But I was just acting my age, really. You know, Russ actually left me. His whole family said, my God, Russ, you can't just break up a marriage because they're having a bad week.
Hi, I'm Dave Gebro. I threw my career as a licensed hearing instrument specialist in the trash, sold my house, and moved to the East Coast with my wife and 4-year-old son in order to focus on making the ultimate podcast for music obsessives thrive. Now I need your help. Although Discography is rated in the top 2% of all podcasts globally, the economics of this thing are tricky. Becoming a member of Discography's Patreon gives you access to over 100 more exclusive episodes. episodes, and moving forward now every Sunday for only $5 a month as a private first class, you get our new weekly show by and for Discography's Patreon family, the Discography Soldiers of Sound podcast. If all you want to do is show some love, there's now finally a $1 tier. Don't miss out. Become a recruit and get your personalized backstage pass for $1. And for the cheapskates, homeless people, and all the bums sponging off mom and dad, don't care, just join. It's now completely free to join as a basic member, and it'll be the only place you'll be able to get our upcoming Lou Barlow, Corey Hansen, Mark Robinson, Will Hart comp, Metal Machine Muzak, as well as the triple album rock opera Elf Harmony I created with Joe Kennedy, and the ability to purchase one-off Patreon episodes. That's it, back to the show. You know what's amazing about this whole thing is that we're talking about 1963, and the two of you are already living in 1968. You're already practicing free love. There's no name for it yet, but you're living in the later part of this. That's what it seems like anyway, is like the seeds are being sown for go where you want to go and be who you want to be with, but there's no terminology for it yet. And so it feels confusing and weird, probably weirder than it would feel later on.
Let me just interject this one little thing. There is no such thing as free love. You pay for it.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I'll talk with you about this later, but I'm a filmmaker and I'm trying to get a 1960s psychedelic horror movie off the ground called Bad Vibes. And the tagline is free love, ... or else. Okay, so the Rust thing, I got to say that it is my favorite affair ever. And here's why. If all infidelity would be responsible for a starburst of artistic greatness, everybody would be fucking everybody else. Because out of that affair, whether or not there was pain that came out of it, you have Monday, Monday, Go Where You Want to Go, Look Through Your Window, maybe more.
The song that was written at that time, California Dreamin', had not been written yet.
Right.
Monday, yeah. Monday had not been written yet. But Go Where You Want to Go was all about the Russ Titelman affair. And I think also that gave John an inkling of the way his songwriting had to change from Me and My Uncle and folk songs. He knew he had to get away from that, but he just didn't know how. And so I think in a way I gave him an opportunity to write a really commercial song. And that was the first really commercial song that he wrote.
He helped you find your voice and you gave him his voice.
Yes, I think that's a very good way to put it.
Yeah. And also, up until this point, John's not exactly, you know, the picture perfect husband and boyfriend. He was a scoundrel. I'm not even speaking ill of the dead. This is just what he was. And so he was legitimately getting a taste of his own medicine. It's hard really to feel bad for the guy. And, you know, these songs, it's funny that all of this greatness came from finally understanding what it's like to have your ass handed to you. But then around that time, I believe, a little bit later is when you wrote California Dreamin'.
That's correct. We wrote California Dreamin' once we were in New York, settled in New York, and I wanted to come back to California so badly. I begged him. But, you know, the music business was in New York. It was not in California. Nobody recorded hits in Los Angeles. And I know when he woke me up in the middle of the night, he thought he was onto something commercial when he said, all the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. I've been for a walk on a winter's day. And it all was started by us walking down Fifth Avenue just a few days before that. And I saw this beautiful church and I said, what is that? And he said, that's St. Patrick's Cathedral. And I said, let's go inside. He said, no, I don't want to go inside. You go. I said, come on, let's go. He says, no, you go. And I went into the church. And the reason John did not want to go in is he had a terrible relationship with religion in general. I mean, when he was 7 years old, he was put into a Catholic military school where he only saw his family on Sundays. He was just a little boy all by himself. Coming from a military family, he was expected to go on to Annapolis and all that, which he did. But he hated the military and he hated Catholicism. He hated religion in general. I mean, if you can imagine that he wouldn't even go to St. Patrick's Cathedral just to show me how beautiful it was inside, that's saying a lot. He was not two-faced about that at all. So that's why I actually wrote, and I got down on my knees and pretend to pray.
Which is interesting because there's a cover where it's, I began to pray, which is really just chopping the song off at the knees.
Yeah.
Pretend to pray is the best part of the song, I think. I love that.
Well, that's the only part of California Dreamin' that I wrote. The melody was already there, and the first part of the first verse was there, and the chord structure was already there. And I remember him saying, wake up, help me write this. You'll thank me for this someday. And boy, do I thank him every day.
Let me ask you a serious question, though. Okay, California Dreamin' is a monumental, mythologically huge song. Is it actually one of your favorite Mamas and Papas songs? Or do you feel like this is the rest of the world song? I prefer Straight Shooter. I prefer this, that.
Well, you know, I love California Dreamin'. I love Go Where You Want to Go. I despised Monday Monday.
Really?
God, we were staying at my godmother's house, at Marika's house, and he always had his guitar strapped to his body. And he came out of the bedroom and he said, I want to write a song with universal appeal. And Cass and I were playing gin, and I remember the two of us just going, he said, that's a fabulous idea, John. You just go ahead and write a song with universal appeal. He went back, he thought, oh, God, these two girls don't know what they're saying. And he came back out and he said, how about Monday, Monday, can't trust that day. Monday, Monday, sometimes it just turns out that way. And we roared with laughter. We said, that is the most pretentious lyric that I have ever heard. And he's, of course, he's got his feelings hurt. And he said, what do you mean? That's a good lyric. And and Cass said, John, it's not a good lyric. It's a horrible lyric. And Danny said, I have to kind of agree with the girls. So then he goes and he makes us sing it for Lou Adler. Though by this time, I'm skipping ahead a little bit. When John made us sing it for Lou Adler, he said, God, that's great. That's really great. And he said, let's record it today. And I said, Lou, let's not record it. That could be the end of what was a very promising career for all of us. And he said, Mitch, why don't you do the singing and I'll do the releasing? I said, oh, all right, fine. So we recorded it, shot to number one. And then Cass and I were so hypocritical, really, because we were at press conferences. We were saying, well, we told him he should write a song with universal. Yeah, it's great. And then I remember Denny saying, and those ba-da, ba-da-da-das, magic. Well, but you get to love a number one single. You get to love it.
Very soon after that, you guys meet Denny Doherty on the Hootenanny tour in October or November 63. Denny joins the group. In 64, you team up as the New Journeyman along with Marshall Brickman, who later, of course, co-writes Annie Hall.
And also wrote the book for Jersey Boys, nominated for an Academy Award.
Now let's talk about Escatrol and how important that was to the band at this point in time.
That's how you stayed awake. I don't know how you stay awake, but in those days, Escatrol was the answer to, and Benny's. We all took Benzedrine, and I guess that Escatrol was probably just another form of Benny's. But John had already found that it was very easy for doctors to prescribe, especially to musicians, because they understood, being on the road and how, you really had to have that extra little punch. And so everybody was taking Benny's or Escatrol, and it did keep you awake, and it actually helped you write songs.
And rehearse, because when Denny came in, I believe it was 3 days to learn the entire repertoire. So Escatrol creates an environment where Denny can be imbued into the band's fabric very, very quickly. And then all of a sudden, your drug of choice changes. Marshall leaves the group. John buys acid for the very first time. And when he pulls up at home with two caps that he had purchased for apparently 10 bucks a piece, it's cheaper now. I don't know how that works. There's Cass, born Ellen Naomi Cohen, standing at your door waiting for you.
That's when the acid hit me. You have to keep in mind something. Acid was not illegal.
Right.
It was not an illegal drug. Acid was just something that made you feel weird as hell, but fun. And it was definitely party time once we discovered acid. But it was the same with the uppers. You know, any doctor would give you uppers. I never gave it a second thought because they came from John's doctor. So
must be okay.
It must be okay. And I'm sure that's what a lot of people think of now. If they get opiates from their doctor, they probably say, well, you know, my doctor gave it to me so I can take five of them, you know. So drugs, you know, I will say this. If you didn't try LSD or psilocybin or any kind of psychedelic in the 60s, it's not the same thing now.
Why do you say that?
Because you never know what you're getting, first of all. We had the purest. It was made in a lab that we actually knew. They had pamphlets.
Was that night the first time you ever tripped?
Yes.
It was.
It was the night we met Cass Elliott.
Was that everybody's first trip?
Yes.
I don't think it was Cass's first time, was it, Michelle?
I think it was.
Okay.
I may be wrong about that, but I always thought it was.
It may have been.
When was the last time you did LSD?
Oh, God. Back in probably 72 or 73. I was never really into drugs, and I didn't consider these drugs because, right, as I said, the doctor gave them to me.
No, but acid legitimately is, it's not like you can get addicted to acid. It's an easy drug, at least in my experience, an easy drug to walk away from.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we took it as a party thing, you know, like alcohol, but it was more fun than alcohol and you didn't get sick.
Okay. Tell me about the trip the four of you had that night and how did it change your life forever?
Yeah. Well, when I opened that door, after I heard the doorbell and I opened the door, all of a sudden, when I looked at this woman standing in front of me, she weighed about 300 pounds. She had a pink Angora sweater, a white pleated skirt and go-go boots up to here, a little white go-go boots. And the LSD just kind of washed over me. And I really didn't know if I was seeing correctly, you know, but she said, hi, you know, she was very chirpy and funny. And she was really funny. She was the funniest woman I had ever met in my life. And certainly one of the funniest people I ever met in my life. And Cass and I just bonded that night. That first night, we were inseparable. She was telling me all these stories about her life. And she was telling me how Barbara Streisand, that bitch, got the part in Funny Girl that she had auditioned for. And I'm like, oh my God, she's such an interesting person. And John and Denny were, you know, everyone just got together. But Cass arrived with the Beatles album.
I believe it was Meet the Beatles, right?
It was the first album, but it had been out for a while, but we'd never heard it. And I remember putting on those earphones and listening to the Beatles for the first time on acid. And it was, oh man, you know, this is how you got to write now, John. These are the kinds of songs that you have to write.
That was really the divide there, Dave, because Cass and Denny and the Mugwumps, that's what they were moving towards, constantly trying to be Beatle-like.
Right.
They went and saw Hard Day's Night repetitively with Zol Yudovsky. I mean, Cass was rather obsessed with the Beatles, and because Denny was a Canadian, he kind of had a head start on the Beatles. So they are coming into this meeting with John and Michelle, and they're pretty frothing at the mouth about the Beatles more than most Americans would have been, certainly more than John was, right, Michelle?
Oh, well, John had never heard the Beatles, but he got it. He did get it. He said, okay, but he wasn't sure he knew how to do it.
Well, I know Denny almost acted like a cult leader. He had him sit down on the ground and put two speakers on either side of his head and ordered him to listen to it. I mean, the story now is, you know, for hours and hours and hours and hours, but it's who knows? True. And then something clicked and John got it. And from then on, every single song you guys wrote ended with, yeah.
And that was the night that they put a scarf around my eyes, and we had this big map on the wall of the world, and they twirled me around. They said, throw this dart and wherever it lands, that's where we're going to go. And so we did that, and I threw the dart right to the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Danny came over and he grabbed the dart and he said, and then they swam over here to the Virgin Islands.
That's awesome. I've never heard that part of the story. I thought it was just you pointing right to Virgin Islands. That's great.
Yeah. And so we were in the Virgin Islands within 3 weeks.
You had $7,000 in cash in a suitcase, an American Express card. And John, I don't know if you joined him, but I know he took mescaline for the plane ride, right?
I don't remember that at all.
That's what he says in his book. And then you guys get down there and he buys a certain green Gucci bag.
That's not true.
Oh, it's not? Okay.
The green Gucci bag was bought when we were coming out of ABC Dunhill in New York City. And we walked into Gucci and we dropped about $8,000 in luggage. And that little bag was part of our luggage, John and mine. And it was a beautiful little bag. But then it turned into his drug bag.
If you just say those three words to me, green Gucci bag, I have a visceral reaction because I know what's been in that bag. But so, you know, the stuff that eventually winds up in that bag doesn't play any kind of role. Right now, you guys are running on pure lysergic inspiration. You've got 50 hits of acid loaded up in a feed bag. John takes mescaline before boarding the plane. You're out of here. You go down to the Virgin Islands and camp out at the beach on a site that you call Camp Torture and spend your days snorkeling on acid, right? Oh, hi. I got to tell you about the next tier. As a lieutenant, you get an ad-free, substantially elongated director's cut of every episode. And you'll be getting the shows a few days earlier than the general populace, which is designed to make you feel even more special than you already are. And now back to our expertly crafted program.
We snorkeled on acid and we swam through millions of beautiful little red and blue and yellow and green fish. And it was when Denny and I first started to look at each other in a different way. When you're just playing on the beach, living in tents, we lived in our bathing suits, and Cass is the one who actually brought the acid down.
Right.
She couldn't go with us when we first left because she was doing the Danny Kaye show.
Of course.
And so we knew that she would eventually come down, and she was totally broke because they'd stolen her wallet at the airport. But she did have 50 hits of acid, probably more. It was liquid. And we would wake up in the morning, and this guy would come every morning with a cooler. And inside were all these cold coconuts. And he would take his machete and slap off the top of the coconut. And then he'd pour the rum in it. And that was breakfast.
Nice.
And, you know, Denny and I and Cass had told me how in love she was with Denny and had been for a long time throughout the Mugwumps. From the time they met, she fell in love with Denny. And she told me that the first night that we had acid together. And then I started to see Denny in a completely different way. And when we would...
You are trouble.
I am trouble.
Yeah.
For instance, we would be rehearsing on the beach and I would come in late, for instance, or I wasn't doing something right. And John would innocently say something like, just look into Denny's eyes and then you'll know when to come in. Just follow Denny. You look right into his eyes. Well, let me tell you something. That was really bad for John, because Denny and I would look into each other's eyes and go, oh, man, I want to fuck this guy so bad.
Oh, that's so funny.
And that's how the flirtation just got totally out of hand. I mean, Denny and I would be rehearsing, and he'd have his foot on top of my foot under the table. And I would be looking into his eyes, and we would be singing to each other, basically. And it all went unnoticed. John didn't notice it. Cass didn't notice it. But it was a flame. It was getting bigger and bigger all the time.
Let me ask you a quick question, if I may, just interject.
Okay.
Do you think, looking back, that the whole thing was so appealing to you because it was verboten and you just were kids? Or do you feel like you were in love with him?
Well, that's an interesting question. Let me just say this. Denny and I never took it past a certain point, but every full moon, we would hire a catamaran and go out and be in the Caribbean for hours at a time, just holding on to the ropes. And it was a very sensual experience. And the acid was helping too.
Yeah.
And one night when we got back to the dock, Cass and John, Denny jumped into the bay and I jumped in after him. And Cass and John were talking and they said, we're going back up. So they went back up Creek Alley to Duffy's.
Which we haven't, by the way, mentioned yet. So let's just establish right. That Duffy's was a club, would you call it? Or?
It was a club. And we were kind of singing there, the cast. But
and living there eventually.
We were living there at the time. And so Denny and I are in the bay together. A little while later, we decide to go back up to Duffy's. And I remember walking up the alley and Denny took my hand. This was not something we had ever done. He actually touched me with something other than his foot. And all of a sudden, he just pushed me against the wall and he said, I'm going to kiss you now. And he leaned over and he gave me the most romantic, beautiful, wet, sloppy kiss you've ever seen. It was so great. And then we just kept walking up the alley. And when we got to Duffy's, he went his way and I went mine. And I remember that afternoon, I said, John, I have to talk to you. And he said, what? What's the matter? I said, I have to talk to you about something. And I said, I think that we ought to move away from Cass and Denny and get our own place. And he said, why? And I said, well, honestly, John, I have to tell you the truth. I'm feeling very attracted to Denny. And I can't stop this attraction that I feel towards him. And John thought about it for a minute. And he turned to me and he said, I wouldn't worry about it, Mitch. Denny has no interest in you. And that was like,
that's so
vegetable.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, really?
Which is interesting because John doesn't strike me as a dumb person. And that's not a smart thing to say.
That's the dumbest thing he ever said.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that, you know, he made a conscious decision about that, that taking the chance between me and Denny or losing his tenor.
I want to get back to the mainland because you guys have business on the mainland.
Yeah.
But I also want to ask you one final question about St. Thomas. Looking back, was that the best time of your entire life? Was it even better than the Mamas and the Papas?
Well, that's very hard to answer. I was having a great time. Cass and I thought we were going to stay there for the rest of our lives, but that's how the cookie crumbles. You know, Cass didn't even want to join the group. So it wasn't like we had this real passion to go back and make a hit. We didn't know if we could even get in the door for an interview, but we had such a wonderful time in the Virgin Islands. I mean, I look back on Camp Torture and it was a wonderful experience for all of us. And we would make bonfires on the beach at night.
Some wild parenting, too, because I know that Mackenzie was out there at Camp Torture.
She was, but she was sent home. Well, her mother didn't want her to stay the rest of her life in St. Thomas with her dad and these crazy people. But she was fun, and she was a great little camper. She lived in a pup tent, you know, but eventually, you know, John had to put her on a flight back to Virginia.
All right, so tell me if I get this right. The four of you are kicked out of Duffy's, and you take over an unfurnished house that you turn into a commune, which is when the governor of St. Thomas orders you all off the island because he thought his nephew was doing drugs with the crazed lunatics down at Creaky Alley.
I actually have no idea if that's a true story because I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. And then one other thing I want to address before news about Mr. Tambourine Man and Do You Believe in Magic start to waft out to you and you start getting antsy is Cass. Okay. There's this story that I guess I'm not really buying because it just makes a great story that a pipe fell on her head and her voice changed. And all of a sudden, John said, "You're in." What really happened?
Okay. I'll tell you what really happened. Yes, the pipe fell on her head. She already had the range. When you hear her singing in the Big Three or any recording that she did long before us, I mean, she had such a range. She was such an incredible vocalist. By the way, John was begging her to join the group, but she did not want to join the group. And she told John that. And he said, "What's the matter with you? Why don't you want to do that?" And she said, "I'm never going to be on stage with Michelle because I'm never going to let an audience see the obvious distinction between us." And John said, "Cass, this isn't a beauty contest. This is about the way we sound. This is about the way we sing together." And she said, I just don't want to do it." And John actually said to her, and I swear this is true, he said, "Well, you know, maybe we should just form a label, call it Fat Records."
Oh, Lord.
And she said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, you know." And then the marquee can say, "Another obese release from Fat."
Oh, God.
Is that Bieber?
That is really true. I swear, that is really true. And she thought that it was so funny. But going a little ahead of this, when he sang that lyric to her from Creek Alley and "No One's Getting Fat Except Mama Cass," I wouldn't sing it to her. I said, "You can't do this. You cannot sing this to her." He says, "That's the lyric." I said, "Well, you sing it to her. I'm not going to sing it to her." And she came over and she's sitting there and she says, "Well, what's this song you're writing?" And I'm going, "Oh, God, help." And we get to the line. I turn my back on her and John. I do not sing her the lyric. John sings her the lyric. And she's got a pillow on her stomach. And she throws him the pillow. And she says, "That is fucking brilliant."
Oh, that's good. Because every time I hear it, I actually feel bad for her. Like, my heart goes out to her.
John always wanted Cass to join. But she was very concerned about being on stage with me. And she was singing the fourth part from the floor because she became a waitress at Duffy's. And people would say awful things to her.
You know what I feel the saddest for her about is, you know, that little the squiggle drawing where she's a bass drum?
Lou Adler, actually, that was an ad. And it wasn't something that she took offense to at all. She loved it.
Okay, good.
You know, Cass was used to that. She was overweight from the time she was 7 years old.
But it's not that. It's that struggle's real on its own. Then she has to spend her career standing next to one of the most beautiful women that ever walked the face of the earth.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hello?
And so, really. So that's a whole other bag. Because then it shines a really harsh personal spotlight down on herself, which probably when she shuts the door at the end of the night, when the party's winding down, something like that hits people. It just hits people.
David, I have to say something about Cass. She had the audience in the palm of her hand every night that we were on stage. I was too shy, too intimidated to speak on stage. I could not speak on stage. She was so quick and funny, and nobody had ever seen anything like her before.
Yeah.
And Mama Cass, even though she didn't really like being called Mama, her talent could shine through so much that she finally, and I think she always felt this way, that she was bigger than herself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know,
yeah.
She was great and she knew it.
So getting back to the mainland, this is another mythological story, but this one I buy, which is crazy because the circumstances are just completely insane. You had a $30,000 overage on the Amex card. It was cut up. You had no way to get back to the mainland. So you threw on a red dress. Then what happened?
Okay. First of all, it was about $7,000.
Okay.
John loves to exaggerate. Everything is bigger, better, redder, you know.
Listen, my credo is always trust the junkie.
Yeah, really. If you want the real truth, the real story, ask a donkey.
So when you become a major, you'll be getting access to the ultimate director's cuts of all our sprawling super deep dive episodes. As far as I'm concerned, these super cuts have absolutely everything that was meant to be heard. Plus, you get yours before the lieutenants get theirs. But that ain't it. You also get all our other series, like Discography's Top 10, our buried treasure show, Rock Cousteau, our slag-off show, Queasy Listening, and exclusive limited series like The Private Press with Paul Major. And if you've got no financial worries to speak of, keep in mind that some of the higher Patreon tiers allow you to actually advertise on the show, choose the bands we cover, or even some of the guests we get. For the price of a cup of coffee a week, you can ensure my family's fed, build a music library that'll be the envy of your block, and connect to a thriving community of music maniacs all at the same time. Don't risk feeling badly about yourself by not giving. Patreon.com/discograffiti. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti.
We took a flight from St. Thomas to Puerto Rico, and they took our bad check. But when we got to Puerto Rico, either TWA or Pan Am or whoever it was would not take our bad check to go to New York. And no matter how charming John would be, this agent was saying, no, you can't pay with that check. And our American Express card had been cut up right in front of us. It was one of the most horrifying moments of my life. But John said to Denny, how much money do we have? Denny said, well, we've got about $27. And John said, well, there's only one thing we can do with this. We just have to take it to the tables. We looked at him like he'd lost his mind. We said, what do you mean? Gamble it? He said, yeah, that's the only thing we can do with it. And swear to God, I did not put on a red dress. I didn't have a red dress. I had my jeans and a t-shirt. My hair was long and stringy. And we looked like something out of a Scooby-Doo cartoon or something. And we went to the casino. We didn't know what else to do with the $27. So we did what John wanted us to do. And I had never played craps before in my life. But the croupier said, okay, little lady, you throw the dice. I said, okay, I throw the dice. Pass one. All right. We've just doubled our money. And then he gives me the dice again. Go on, little lady. You're doing real good. So I threw 17 straight passes, which is really a lot. We had a table covered with people just watching us turn this $27 into hundreds and hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars. And then we walked away and we went back to the airport and we said, okay, we want to be on flight 16 to New York. And she said, I see you got your money. And he said, yeah, and we're flying first class.
Of course. Nice. That's an incredible tale. I mean, it's almost like destiny is pushing the four of you to to where you're supposed to be. Plus, you know, when you're on psychedelics, it just feels like the flow. It's supposed to be going. This is supposed to be happening. So it probably didn't even seem weird.
Of course, you know, Cass had gone on ahead of him because she was the only one that had a round trip ticket. So this is all happening without her presence.
She had a round trip ticket and she flew from New York to California right away. But I wanted to just tell you this one story before we get off the island, okay? We're sitting at Duffy's one morning around 7 o'clock in the morning drinking beer, listening to the radio, and we hear the beginning of Mr. Tambourine Man. And we're saying, oh my God, listen, that's Mr. Tambourine Man. And then they start singing. And John says, my God, is that the Birds? And the Birds were just a little tiny group that used to open for people at the Troubadour.
The Beefeaters. That's what they were initially called, the Beefeaters. Oh, well,
I think they were already the Birds by the time we were experiencing this. And Cass or John or somebody says, my God, that is the Birds. Oh, my God, we've got to get to Los Angeles right away, because if the Birds can have a hit, anybody can have a hit.
That's great.
Anyhow, we ended up back in New York and we didn't really know what we were going to do, but we did have to get to Los Angeles. So we got a driveway.
Hold on, you load a stash bag with acid, weed, brown Lebanese hash, and black beauties, correct? I got to keep a tag.
I don't think we have any acid left at this point.
Okay.
So we basically left everything in New York and went down to the driveway, it was called, where you could get a car. You know, this particular car, they said, look, we've got a car going to San Francisco. We said, we'll take it. And it was a 1964 limousine. And I think that was one of those really important moments that showed us that we had something, we were facing something great. We had to get to Los Angeles. We were going to have hits. And when we got to Los Angeles, one of the very, very first people that we ran into was Barry McGuire. We go to Barry McGuire's house on Clark Street in Hollywood, and Cass answers the door. And we said, what the hell? What are you doing here? And she says, well, I'm staying with Barry. So she says, come on in. And Barry says, come on in. You know, and we start staying with Barry and we start singing. And he says, you know, you guys sound really good. I think you ought to go sing for my producer. I've got a really cool guy who produced Eve of Destruction. He had a number one hit at this point when we came to see him. He said, I think that Lou Adler would be really good for you guys. And so we ended up going to Western Studios on Sunset Boulevard, studio number 3. And we sang. By this time, John had written Monday, Monday. And we had California Dreamin', Go Where You Want to Go.
This is where I get to say, because usually the run-up, meaning everything up to the first album, I try to talk fast, get to the first release real quick. You know, let's do it with pure economy. But this particular instance, it's an Odyssey-like saga before you even get to record number one. In a lot of ways, the seeds of destruction are already sown. So all the material that came up to that point, it's like the whole history of the band had already happened. It just hadn't been released yet.
Right.
Which is amazing. Okay, yeah. So phase one, everything's going our way, 1965 to 1967. So November 65, Barry McGuire's This Precious Time LP, his second album of 1965, which I prefer greatly to Eve of Destruction, mainly because you guys hijacked the record, and rightly so. You're not on every song, but the songs that you're all on, what I love about those songs, especially the title track, because when the four of you come in, even just thinking about it right now, I'm getting chills up and down my spine. The way the four of you, and Richard knows what I'm talking about, the way the four of you, just the harmonies gently insinuate themselves into the track, it's like four stars are born immediately.
Also, you have to remember that we had never sung with anything but one guitar.
And not in a studio, right? This is your first time in a studio?
No, not in a studio.
What was that like for you? Was it like, oh, I found what I want to do, or yeah?
Oh, bad. We had it bad. We were listening to ourselves going, oh my God. We sound fabulous.
And you do. Oh my God.
It was just incredible to hear our album being made. David, I also just wanted to give you this visual of when Lou listened to our songs. We sang him the whole thing and he said, listen, why don't you guys come by tomorrow at around 3 and we'll talk about this some more. And we said, okay. So the next day we got there and there were contracts all over the floor. And Cass got down on her knees so fast and she picked up that pen and she started putting her name on. This is when we knew Cass was in the group because she was only going to go with us for the presentation. You know, she was going to sing with us. But she had not agreed to be in the group until she saw those contracts on the floor. And she wanted to work. That's what she did. Everything that she could do, she wanted to work and she needed the money.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, she saw this right in front of her. They actually are making a deal with us.
Is it true? Denny is just saying in his show that Lou said something to the effect of, you know, after the cap goes on, sort of come back in the morning. But to the effect of, what do you need? And you didn't used to play up that John went into businessman mode and said, what we need is a steady flow of money
from your office
to our house. I mean, and that you got $5,000 advances and that it took off right then. Is that true?
And you know, that steady stream of money actually did materialize, because once they realized that we were going to make hit records, whatever we wanted, we got. First of all, we had this in our contract. We had to have a carton of Marlboro Reds. We had to have a case of Crown Royal.
Well, that was more a Denny thing, right?
Yeah. Well, everyone was drinking. You know, it was amazing. I personally never recorded on psychedelics.
Well, from what I understand, you weren't sober when you signed the contracts. You were all high. You came to the office. And by the way, this is the story of every single band, not just of the 1960s, but probably ever. No negotiation. You probably didn't read it.
At that time, John had kind of been around the block a couple of times. And when he said, we want a steady stream of money from your office to our house, that's what happened. And we needed a car. Harold the Bleak materialized. And when we needed new clothes, we were taken to DeVos on Sunset Boulevard, and we got clothes, and we were treated really well.
Did they find the house for you on Flores Street? Was that you all finding that, or did they provide that?
They were paying for it, but I don't know if they found it.
Here's another thing, and I have it placed elsewhere, but it's a good time to talk about it, because now the world is sycophantically bowing at your feet wherever you turn. And it must be a kind of crazy thing to experience, but John is the first. I believe that this emanates from John. Maybe it was you. But his thing, at least that he says all the time, is that you got to treat yourself a star, and then everyone's going to treat you like a star too. And honestly, that was something that it just stuck in my head, because yeah, of course, you know, and he was doing that when he was a junkie, treating himself like a star, going around in limousines in New York. So at this time, do you feel like it was John that was pushing that concept, or the four of you?
Well, you have to understand that there was an axis changing time in all of these concerts that these old folk kids were doing. You know, they'd now turned into rock stars. And, you know, when we went on tour, we didn't go in a bus. We went in a Learjet. We never traveled anywhere.
Weren't you the first to do that, though? Richard, they were the first, right?
Yes, I think so.
They were. Yeah.
I mean, it was all cars and vans until you guys showed up.
Right. And you get used to that kind of stuff, you know? When you've got so much money, you go from having nothing to having $1 million, you know? I remember when John and I walked into Peter Satori Jaguar in Pasadena, and there were these two beautiful XKEs on the floor. And we just walked in and said, well, we'll take those two. And the salesman was telling us what a good deal he could get for us, you know, payment wise. And I said, that's okay. You know, and we open this bag and we take out all this cash. You know, it was like you get used to being rich very quickly.
By the way, at this point, is John still throwing you a book every now and then to appease your dad?
That's how my father always was. I mean, when he said that, he really meant educate her, please. Someone's got to.
But your dad had no idea that you were, I'm guessing, even aiming toward the music industry. And now all of a sudden you're this massive superstar. Was your dad like, what the fuck is going on out there?
Listen, my father was so proud of me.
Sure.
And so proud of John. And he loved John. John and my dad got along so, so well. At one point in the Mamas and the Papas, he was driving a school bus for a living. He was a merchant marine. But at this point, he was driving a school bus, and he had all Mamas and Papas posters in the inside of the bus.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I was going to say, this is a good time to talk about the name, Michelle, because yeah. I guess it was the new Journeyman when you were in the Virgin Islands. When you played at Duffy's, were you just house band or did you call yourself the new Journeyman still?
Yeah, okay. It wasn't until we were already recording our first album and we were in West Hollywood and we were in a little house on Flores.
Right.
And we were watching the Les Crane show. It was a talk show and we didn't have a name. Dunhill wanted us to find a name for ourselves.
What about the Magic Circle? Was that their idea?
It was just all we could come up with. And it was a rotten title.
Is that an acid reference? It sounds like a trippy acid reference to me.
No, it was. I don't know where that came from. But when we were watching the Les Crane show one afternoon, all of us were on the couch and we're watching this show.
I'm such a history guy. So I can tell you when it was that happened. It was the night of September the 14th, 1965.
And Les Crane was interviewing Sonny Barger, who was the president of the Hell's Angels.
Tomorrow's the anniversary of Altamont, by the way.
Oh, geez. I was there. It was a horror. Oh,
That's right. You were there. Wow.
Yeah.
It may have been a horror, but it's the best the Stones have ever sounded.
Yeah. We all almost got killed, but we're watching Les Crane and he's interviewing Sonny Barger. And Les kind of starts to say in as gentle a way as he possibly can that the girlfriends of the Hell's Angels are sluts. That's what he's implying anyway. And Sonny Barger starts getting closer and closer to him. And we think that this guy is going to be dead in 2 minutes, Les Crane. And Sonny Barger says, "Some people call all women cheap. We just call them our mamas." And Cass just jumped up and said, "Oh, that's it. We're going to be the mamas. I don't know who you guys are going to be, but we're going to be the mamas." And then John said, "Oh, the papas. How about the papas and the mamas? That sounds good, doesn't it?" And we're going, "No, John, it's not the papas and the mamas. It's the mamas and the papas." He says, "All right, okay, fine."
All right, that about does it. Stay tuned because next week we've got part two of Michelle Phillips' The Interview of a Lifetime, in which the mamas and the papas drop their music on the universe and become immensely famous in the process, which can mean only one thing, trouble in paradise. A heartfelt discography thanks goes out to my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Michelle Phillips, Richard Campbell, Fernando Perdomo, Rudy Fishman, Becky Boyd, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, and access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into the greatest music ever made from the 1960s is to leap headfirst into my 12-hour interview with Jules Alexander and Terry Kirkman, the two founding members of Monterey Pop opening act The Association, that's episodes 110 to 113, Vashti Bunyan rating her entire catalog, that's 103 and 104, Os Mutantes Sergio Diaz on the early days of the band, that's 86 and 87. Burt Summer, 83 and 84. A tribute to David Crosby, that's 77 and 78. Lou Barlow rates the Zombies, that's 59 and 60. Bob Forrest on the band, that's 25 and 27. Monkees manager Andrew Sandoval rating the Monkees, that's 22 and 23. The Bee Gees Psychedelic Beginnings, that's episode 10. And Sly and the Family Stone, episodes 5, 6, and 7. Join us during the upcoming week. This Sunday, you can expect another deliriously sociopathic entry of Rudy Fishman's Discography Soldiers of Sound podcast. These are real people with talent and a burning fire deep inside, just like you and I. Get to know your new music-obsessed friends. And of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, March 29th, we're coming at you with Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime, Part 2, Trouble in Paradise. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss it. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discograffiti!
Osiris.